The black hole hovers above the empty seat to my left. A dark heat emanates from its center. A metallic smell overtakes me, the scent of outer space. No one else can see the black hole. It is mine and mine alone. It always has been. Ma'am, I need a dollar, a voice calls over my music. A man stands in the aisle, faded brown suit, too old to blend in here, his eyes bloodshot from age or drink. I don't have any cash, I say. Nothing? Come on. The black hole expands and rotates clockwise. I'm really sorry, I say.
That's Sarah Rose Etter reading an excerpt from her book, Ripe. It's a surreal novel about a young woman named Cassie who is working at a Silicon Valley startup. She was hoping it would be her dream job, but it turns out to be a nightmare. Cassie has to deal with long hours and toxic bosses. She's also dealing with a mysterious black hole inside her. In Ripe, Sarah draws on her personal experience working in tech to ensure that she gets all the details right. I had to ask her how similar Sarah's own work experience is to Cassie's.
I would say her experience is really a composite of things I've seen in tech, not necessarily for companies where I work, but from stories I've heard. You know, it's kind of taking all the worst things that you've seen and combining it into one company. Mm-hmm. it's really a composite. I think this book, rather than being based on my quote unquote reality, is really making sure that it's based on the truth of tech and also just business in general. I mean, honestly, most of these are not new behaviors. They've just taken different shape. You know, we're kind of in this era of conspicuous consumption where for the first time people are hiding wealth and status. And so that always fascinates me because it's really the same sort of behaviors. It's just dressed up as a company that's your friend. It's low key, it's casual, but all of the same things are sort of happening under the surface.
Mm-hmm. You're originally from Pennsylvania. What did you think when you first moved to San Francisco? You'd probably already been there, but when you actually made the move, the commitment to live there, what was that like for you?
I think that part of my experience and Cassie's do intertwine, where I thought I was making this huge life change and things were going to be improved. And sort of shortly after I got there, it became clear that it was much more complicated than that. It's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful city. And I think all the time, like, everyone in San Francisco must hate me right now, because if you wrote this book about Philadelphia, would I be mad? Maybe, you know, but would I also acknowledge like my city is flawed? I think I would be able to say that that is true. It's complicated. I remember my first day walking to the train to go to work. I stopped in a coffee shop and the owner of the coffee shop was there and she was pouring me coffee and she looked very shaken. And she was sort of warning me about San Francisco and saying it's difficult here. And I was like, well, I'm from Philadelphia. I can handle anything. And she told me that the night before a man had set himself on fire outside of the coffee shop and that she had to try to put him out. It was such a strong foreshadowing that it was almost over the top because it broke my heart. And it was sort of that first warning that the city might not have been what I thought it was going to be, which, you know, what we all imagine California to be. It's the gold rush. It's idyllic. It's, you know, this place where you're going to find security and become wealthy and all these things.
Mm-hmm. Another possible warning for you was probably the homeless man who lives outside Cassie's window. Because that was a real life experience for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That was really, I don't think I realized how much it impacted me until I moved away and I went to sleep the first night. And I realized that for the last year, it had really kept me awake. Even though I felt like I was sleeping there, it was sort of this cheap sleep because you just hear someone in so much pain. And you know, it's complicated there too, because there's not much you can do to help someone in that scenario. You're not going to call the police, obviously. And you can leave money and you can leave food, but you know, what am I doing really to help someone? And we really were sort of twined together in this way. And it was unbearable to hear someone in that much pain and not really be able to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine it would be. You moved from San Francisco to Los Angeles and you still work in tech. Is it mm-hmm. a better work environment than your Silicon Valley gig?
Absolutely. I did find a very people-first tech company, and I think it takes a lot. You have to kiss a lot of frogs. I do talk about this. It's, you decide to work for a company based on, you know, how many hours of interviews, and you can't really know what's going on until you get in the door. especially with tech, especially when it's so much proprietary stuff and you're not really sure what they're doing with data, or, you know, you can't really fully understand the culture until you're there. And I think this was a good example of that.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that makes Cassie different from everyone else is her miniature black hole. What is the origin story of this black hole that is always with her?
I think the black hole for her represents depression, and I wanted to personify this human emotion that can take on so many shapes and forms. And for the reader, I hope it can mean anything, whether maybe you struggle with anxiety or anger issues or, you know, whatever we're all trying to manage every day as we go to work, as we make money. The black holes were meant to be a stand-in for that. And of course, it was the hardest part to write because we don't fully understand black holes in regular life, let alone turning it into this sort of fictional element. So I think if you've asked me how many times I had to revise that area, I would say it's a lot. But yeah, I do feel like a little bit of an expert in black holes now. Like if you sent me to a black hole convention, I think I could talk like in the basement.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So what would you, can you give us an example of what you would say? What knowledge you would share about black holes?
I think the most fascinating thing to me is the research was so ongoing that I would rewrite the ending of the book a lot, because during the time we were sending it to the printer, they were starting to make new discoveries. And that's when they discovered that there were potentially wormholes in the black holes. And that really changed the whole ending, right? Because it suddenly went from, oh, she's going to be ripped to shreds in this black hole, to, hey, there's actually another option. I don't know. I read so much research. It's hard to say. There was one really nice academic paper that I read about the way we personify black holes. Since we can't understand them, we have to use language like they spit or they consume or they, you know, ingest. They always have to be doing something that feels human to us because we really can't understand them. It's one of the only things in science that has that, where we have had to give it a layman's term and try to make it understandable just to a regular person. So that part always fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that the black hole was a symbol of your grief. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I really don't know if I would have written this book. I thought to myself that San Francisco has kind of been done to death. There's been a ton of tech books, you know, so it's not usually my wheelhouse. But when I lived in San Francisco, I used to call my father all the time, and he would talk me through my struggle with the city and with the industry. And he kept asking me to write a book about it. And so he passed away shortly before we went into lockdown. And I really found myself just with my grief and very isolated. And so I fell into this book as a way to sort of remember him. And so the parts about the father in the book are certainly the things about him I wanted to remember.
Mm-hmm. And I'm very sorry for the loss of your father. He sounds like a really great guy. Like, I love that he would say to you every time you called him from San Francisco, he'd say, write all this down. One day you're going to write a novel and you're going to make $1 million.
I didn't make $1 million, but I did okay this time.
Well, there's still time. I mean, the book just recently dropped in the UK, and some people, you know, it's still quite possible. Cassie's mother is not as supportive as her father. And if you don't mind my asking, is that what your real life mother is like?
I think that part is more for the character. I always say this when I write a book, there are certain pages where I'm on the page directly, and there are other pages where it makes the most sense for the character. And I didn't really see this as someone who had two perfectly supportive parents or someone who came from a perfect marriage. And I think that's actually a reckoning a lot of us are having. You know, most of us come from a time where, you know, people didn't go to therapy, they didn't go to couples counseling, they didn't work through stuff like this. And so I had this theory that in your 30s is when you start to look at all the structures that formed you and start to ask questions about them, right? Like, just because the biggest model I had of a marriage was my parents, does that mean it's the right model? You know, just because my family taught me that if I got this job and I went to school, I would be able to own a house and I would be secure. Maybe that's not true anymore. And it really isn't. And so there, of course, needed to be something in the family that offered a friction. I don't think she would work as a character if she just had come from a perfect family where everyone loved her and supported her. So, you know, I think there is definitely tension there.
Yeah, and you need that tension. You want that conflict for dramatic purposes. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and honestly, it could have just as easily been, you know, the father who was, not the best at loving her the way she needed to be loved. In this case, for me, this is where the personal kind of crosses the art is, you know, I wanted to remember my dad. And I kept thinking every day that I was like losing memories of him. And so the only way that I could think to kind of preserve him was to put him in the book.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that you're a big believer in outlining. So many writers, it seems to me, don't want to know where the story is going because they want that surprise element while they're writing. But you feel that you have to outline your books. Why?
I think part of that is having a full-time job, and I don't want to spend 10 years on a book that's never going to get published. In terms of like quote-unquote ambition, mine is not to be famous or make money, but I do want to finish books. You know, that matters to me. And so since I'm pretty short on time, if I don't outline, I will be spinning my wheels. And I think people get really hung up on the idea of outlining as it being final. And it's really not the case. In fact, the outlining means that during the editing process, I'm playing around with parts of the story that are the most important, like the ending, like how the black hole functions. But we don't need to, during editing, go back and gut major plot points. We need to have some basic stuff in place in order for the editing process to actually be meaningful so that we can get down to the sentence level, right? Ultimately, I need to go from, you know, the macro to the micro. And if it's not outlined in some fashion, it's just going to take me forever to get there. And so I don't mean to say anything I outline is set in stone, but I need to have the major beats there so that when my agent's looking at it, when my editor's looking at it, their feedback is way more strategic, or it's way more focused on the line level versus this whole character isn't working.
Sure, that makes total sense. You've said that you want to leave space for the reader to show up. I love that sentence, that thought. How do you do that?
I think you have to let the surrealist element do that. If you think about surrealism as an art form, it's almost more important what the viewer sees in the artwork than what the intention of the artist was. And I do want some of that in my book. People always say, how do you think the ending, like, what was the ending? And I'm like, I don't care what the ending was for me. I know what it was for me, but I'm far more interested in how the reader sees it ending. And the same is true for the black hole or, you know, the knot in the Book of X. I'm much more interested in how the reader engaged with those elements than what my intention was. Whenever I teach, I kind of give this example. If I say, there's a woman named Debbie, she's a mother of seven, she drives a minivan, she is wearing, you know, a dress that's a little too big for her, and she's, you know, 48, versus I just say the word mother. And all of a sudden, all of the things you associate with the word mother can show up, because mother to you signifies a very certain set of habits and emotions and histories and memories. And so I think I'm trying to play with that a little bit.
I was intrigued to discover that you don't consider your competition to be other writers or other books. So what do you see as your competition?
Twitter, Netflix, your phone going off. I mean, it's really, we're in an attention economy at this point. And so I do think every page of a novel has to be doing something. Sometimes in my head, I think of it as like acrobatics on the page. I need to be doing one really cool trick on every page, or you have every reason to just not read. You know, like it's silly to think of myself in competition with other writers, because as we all know, people don't read a lot. And so my competition is the real world and a million devices and the fact that you have to actually invest hours in order to read a book. And so, you know, I do try to play to the reader's attention span so that it feels, I mean, people have jokingly called this a beach read, and I kind of laugh about it because it's a sad book for sure. Mm-hmm. But I did try to pace it in a way that the reader would be compelled to finish it.
Mm-hmm, and you definitely did that, I think. So when Netflix comes calling to ask you to turn Ripe into a streaming series, that means you'll be competing against yourself. How will you handle that?
I'm not having those conversations until the strike is over.
Okay, fair enough. Good answer. Sarah Rose Etter, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Ripe. It's a fantastic, one-of-a-kind novel. And congratulations on everything coming up, Etter. It's very well deserved.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your great questions.
Sarah Rose Etter is the author of the novel Ripe. Find out more about Sarah and Ripe at wpr.org/beta.
But I think I was also sort of interested in creating a sequence in the book that maybe put you into the position of one of these women in the murder ballads.
Coming up, Christine Potter joins us to talk about her haunting photographs and their connection to murder ballads. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.